over Baghdad has been illuminated. We're seeing bright flashes going on all over the sky.
Welcome to another episode of Radio Contra, the podcast of American Partisan and the home of the boys that are always down to Boogaloo. This is NC Scout coming to you live from the G Camp in northern rural North Carolina, the home of Nathaniel Green's very famous crossing of the Dan at Boyd's Ferry. The home of the Battle of Alamance, the home of Revolution. And it's good to be with you once more. I would like to say, for all of you that were expecting an episode and kept finding a rather long hiatus, I'm back. And to the loyal readership of American Partisan, the loyal listenership, the many, many emails that I have received, I believe that I owe some of y'all a little bit of an explanation. So, getting into the training end, had a number of training dates that were back-to-back, got a little bit behind, and as the COVID-19 Chinese virus stuff kicked off, things got even further behind. But not only that, unfortunately, I had a couple of deaths that were very, very close to home, and I had to attend to those first. Family always comes first, and so for this, writing comes kind of natural to me, and it's a creative outlet. And as far as making podcasts, I like to talk to, as some of y'all already know, but family always comes first, and I have to balance the needs of the many, many things that I have to do on top of family requirements. And when that happens, and unfortunately sometimes it does, as hopefully all of you out there can relate to, you have to put priorities first. But with that said, here I am, ready to rock and roll, and ready to give you the absolute best. And I'll tell you that if I can't give my personal best to something, as those of you out there who have trained with me know, I'm not going to do it. I'm not one to half-ass anything. I never have and I never will. And I'm going to give you the absolute best. So, with that said, I hope everybody out there is doing really well and staying healthy from this Chinese virus. The economic pinch is hitting pretty much everybody. And as I've said numerous times, I don't think that we're even in the beginning of this thing yet. I don't think that we're in the beginning of this thing when it comes to the economic fallout, the civil unrest fallout, the attacks on the Second Amendment. But, I mean, with that said, there's a whole lot of people, evidenced by the number of gun sales that have went through, the amount of ammunition that has been sold, which is currently a run on, by the way. There's a lot of people that are waking up to the reality of the situation. And I'm going to be quite frank about it. I'm really happy to see that. You know, there's some good things to take away from this whole situation as well. And it's the fact that a lot of people are taking responsibility. They're waking up to the fact that, you know, where does our food really come from? You know, what are some of the pitfalls of the just-in-time supply system? What are some of the potential dangers of this? And I need to take responsibility for me. And from a libertarian standpoint of self-sufficiency, self-reliance, it's a horrible time, but it's a good time. You know, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. so to speak. But with that said, I would like to also share with you a little peek behind the curtain from us just 1 week ago. And I received no less than 24 emails about, but as many of you probably saw last Tuesday, you clicked on American Partisan, you saw a 404 not found error. And in short, what happened with that, because it took me by surprise too. I don't know how all this internet stuff works. I just write on it, right? But we got attacked, and we had a very large attack. We've had DDoS attacks in the past, never one to this magnitude. And our web host contacted us basically saying that our site was under a major attack and it caused their server to go offline due to its size and scope. So they shut us down temporarily. So a couple of takeaways from that. Number one, took about 12 hours. Site was back up. My friend, very close friend, one of the unsung heroes of the Liberty Movement from all that he does behind the scenes, but Johnny Mack, who backs the site up every so many hours to make sure that as an insurance policy, if we ever get attacked of this magnitude, that we're going to be good to go. But on top of that, as many people have told me in emails that they've sent since we resolved that, if you're catching flack, that means you're over the target. And like I said, I received no less than 24 emails. I counted them, it was 24 exactly, emails of people asking what had happened. And man, I'm really honored by that. Because it's one thing to click on a site that you enjoy and it's not there and you don't see it. And you're like, all right, well, you know, maybe they're having some technical difficulty, whatever. It's a whole other thing to take the time to email the people that write for it and say, hey, what happened to this site? It means that you care. And for 24 people to email me personally and ask, and you know, some of these people I know, and have had in class, but the bulk of these people were people that I've never talked to or emailed before. And that means that what we're doing with our site really means something to y'all. And that, in turn, that loyalty of readership really means the world to me. And I'll be honest with you, it meant the world to me at a time where it was a difficult time on this end. And I really, really thank you for that. Cannot thank you enough. And I'm going to say that you are the reason that we do what we do. There is never going to be a time where we leave involuntarily. We will always, as long as I have breath in my body, I will always be there to give 100%, shoulder 100% and then some, more than my share of the task, whatever it may be, for you. Because it is that important to me. What we are doing, what you are doing, by reading the site, by clicking the PDF link down in the bottom, you see an article that you really like. You click on that, you can get a PDF version of it. By supporting our site sponsors, you guys are out there really doing the stuff. By coming to class and training, maybe by not coming to class and training, but getting out there with somebody and training and doing something. You're the ones out there doing it. And I really, really, really respect you and appreciate that. From me personally, I'll speak for everybody else here at American Partisan. We really appreciate that. When we give you articles like the Chinese Baidu guidance system and what frequencies they operate on. One of my contacts who has substantial service in a very well-known unit of a foreign military force sent me an email that was pretty funny about how it's real strange that we disappeared right after I ran that article. But it's there. And kind of talk about some of the dark arts of, give you a peek behind the curtain, rather, of how systems can be interfered with. Not that you ever would or ever should, but just how other nation states or groups might do it. Anyway, but with that said, shout out to some of our sponsors, Primary Arms. Primary Arms, maker of some of the best affordable glass on the market, but a heck of a lot more than just that. They've got literally every product that you might need for shooting out there, including vendors such as BCM, Viltor, Vortex Optics, and, you know, of course, they're in-house brands as well that I have substantial experience with. Check them out, though. Primary Arms. And, of course, my friend Josiah McCallum over at Palmetto State Armory. Palmetto State Armory, to give you a little story about them, they were one of our first advertisers. And he really took a chance on us. You know, my friend John Ammon, UW Gear, maker of just outstanding chess rigs, put me in contact with Josiah. He's been working with him for a long time and said, you know, hey, you two need to meet. And he arranged a phone call and we started talking and you know, he made time in his incredibly busy day just to talk to me and said, you know, this was back in the early days of the site. Said, you know, well, your SEOs are not, you know, super high, and maybe your stats from day to day could be a little bit better and whatnot, but I tell you what, I'll take a chance, and we're going to get you set up with some advertising, and they did. And now look at where we are. You know, we have, on average, 5,000 hits a day. At that time, we had about 2,000, and here we are. You know, our peak day, we had over 17,000 hits, and we maintained that for a while. On a really, really good day, sometimes, and we'll normally have that and hit that in about mid-month, we'll have 10,000 hits a day. We're shared all over social media. People know who we are. And again, that is because of you. That is because of you. But Palmetto State Armory, excellent company. And right now in my hands, I have one of their AKPs. And it's what I'm calling the SOP mod version, because this thing's got a M4 arm brace. Not a stock, it's an arm brace. But it's also got a M-Lock rail interface system. And you guys are going to be seeing a whole lot about that in the very near future. I got an RTO class coming up this weekend, but I am going to make some time to really put this thing through its paces. And, you know, I've got a Kalashnikov class too on the docket. So if you want to get experience running a Kalashnikov and really seeing what can be done when you're modernizing a Kalashnikov, come check it out. Yeah, come check it out and stay tuned, because you're going to be seeing a lot of pics and a lot of cool things in the very near future. Anyway, with that said, I want to share with you this interview that I did a couple of weeks ago with a good friend of mine, a guy who's been to class. He came to the RTO class about a year ago. He's a bladesmith by the name of Mark Cutright. And he and I just talked and talked and talked into long hours of the night after class about knives, knife steel, what goes into basic survival knives, because he is big into the survival and training scenes as well. And I was blessed enough to do a really good interview with him, and I think I got a lot out of it. And I think that you guys will as well. So with that said, I'm going to turn it over to the interview. And fellas, thanks again. Stay healthy.
And we're live with Mark Cutright, maker of awesome knives, a guy that I've had in my RTO class. Big into the bushcraft scene as well as competitive shooting. The guy is what I consider a very well-rounded survivalist, especially for a guy that has no military background. And I think that that brings a very unique approach to survivalism and to the topic in general, which is relevant to a lot of folks out there. Mark, it's good to be with you, brother.
Oh, well, thanks for having me on, man.
Yeah, man.
You're entirely too flattering.
Nah, man. It's always an honor to speak with you, to have you on. Bladesmith, as a guy, knows a huge amount about knives. Bro, you have forgotten more about knives than I will. So it's an honor for me to be speaking with you. But, you know, so I remember back when we were trading emails when you were first coming out to the RTO course, we were talking about knives and we had a pretty cool conversation. Do you recall that?
I want to say that we were talking about Ontario knives and, you know, just general realistic knife usage, but I don't remember a lot of details. That was what, I guess maybe 2 years.
Yeah, it was a while back, man. I recall, I checked you out. You sent me your, a link to your site and I was checking your knives out and I immediately knew this guy knows his stuff and he has done his homework when it comes to requirements of a survival blade, because I didn't see any crazy freaking Rambo knives. You know, I saw very simple, down-to-earth bushcraft knives. I don't think you had anything that was over 6 inches. Flat grind, Scandi grind, your choices of steel was superb. You were doing things in 1080, which was which is a great selection. I thought that was a really good selection, a balance between tensile strength and edge retention. And then you had another steel too. It was a CR steel. I think it was an 80 CR?
Yeah, 80 CRV2.
That's
you can basically think of that as like a 1080 improved, or another way to think of it is 5160 with 0.2 or 20 points of carbon more. So it's awesome. Yeah, it's a lightly alloyed 1080 and it's good stuff. And I'll tell you, I like carbon steels. As a knife maker, they're fairly easy to deal with, but as a knife user, they really shine. One of the things that we talked about in our class, actually, not in the class, but afterwards, was, you know, being out there and being able to sharpen a knife.
Exactly.
There's some really awesome, really complex, miraculous steels out there. I mean, there's probably 15 of them that are just incredible. And for edge holding, I mean, they can't be beat. Most of them were actually formulated as cutlery steels. They didn't come from industry and were repurposed. They were actually designed from the ground up to be used in knives. S30V and just a whole slew of them. And S30V is even getting old now. I think there's S45V out now. I'm not much of a steel snob, but for real work, I like a knife that I can go grab a river rock or a piece of sandstone and go put a working edge on.
Amen.
That and yeah, and I don't have to bring a sharpening stone into the field, or at least not much of one to go touch something up.
Because, I mean, how many times do you come across a diamond rod or a ceramic rod in the field?
Well, if you pack one, good for you. you know?
Yeah.
But the problem that I have is that if I pack a ceramic, I like the Spyderco double stuff, okay? But if you sit on that thing, it's two small stones now. Snapped it in half. There's a nice array of sharpeners out there. It's just stuff that gets lost. And truthfully, depending on how long you're out in the field, you might need to sharpen, you might not.
Right. And, you know, that where I was going with my original comment was the thing that I told you that I recall telling you in our email correspondence back and forth was the thing that impressed me with what I saw was that your knives resembled old kitchen knives, like old hickory knife designs. And, I've got a book over here on my bookshelf called Firearms, Traps, and Tools of the Mountain Men. Excellent reference. And what we see in the bushcraft community, the contemporary bushcraft community, is kind of a return to these old utilitarian designs. And so I really appreciated that, man. And that's something that I've said about knives for a long time, that, you know, a knife's first function is to be able to cut. You know, it's not there to baton through wood, even though that is a test that I use on my own blades to test for the strength, because if it'll survive that, it'll survive pretty much anything else I need for it to do. But, you know, I don't need a big freaking crazy knife that's gonna, you know, make my back hurt or add weight to my kit. I just need something that's gonna be able to cut.
Yeah, the sweet spot that I found is somewhere between about 3 3/4 inches on up to about 6. I was recently talking to a gentleman who owns a very large survival school. It was a chance meeting, and he said kind of between 6 to 9 inches is no man's land. And wouldn't you know it, that's where a lot of the fantasy knives and a lot of the fighting knives wind up landing. I'm not going to discount, you know, all the knives in that range. They're definitely apply, but what are you doing with them? What are you doing with them? Yeah. What I find is I really like 3 3/4 on up to about 4 1/4 inches. That's my personal preference. That's when a blade is still relatively wieldable. Once a knife gets too long, a lot of people lose track of like where the point is. They start running off the work into their legs or into their hand. Look at some of the accidents that people have had with machetes, the swing through and going into their leg. And there's a place. I mean, you know, the Carolinas down south, you know, you guys have got a use for longer, thinner blades, even machetes. Being in Missouri, we've got a lot of hardwoods here, and there's a fair amount of undergrowth that builds up, but there's not a lot of soft vegetation to get through. And so, folks in different areas have different needs, and that is kind of where I started, was what do I want to carry? What are my needs? Let's be realistic about it. And as long as you stay true to that, you know, what's the mission? What are we doing?
Yeah, let's exactly.
Outfit ourselves, man, to meet the needs. That's it. Get away from the fantasies and all that good stuff, and get back to actually using tools and hopefully having a good time doing it.
You mean you don't need a knife that is 8 inches long and has saw teeth on the back of it and, you know, was in a bunch of movies and stuff?
Look, I'm not going to lie. The first time I saw The Hunted, and that Tom Brown tracker knife.
Oh, classic. Classic. Oh, man. I love that movie, man.
If there's anything that makes you want to become a special forces rogue soldier and go hide out in the woods with a sweet knife, it's that movie.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah. Yeah. But I will say that the Tom Brown tracker number one that Topps makes, the quarter inch thick one, did have a buddy that had one and carried it one time in Afghanistan. One time. And he said, never again. This thing is too heavy to be as short as it is, and it has no practical purpose.
So I'm not a historian on that knife, but the fella that was producing that knife that Tom approached, Tom Brown Jr., that is.
It was Dave Beck, wasn't it?
Yes, sir. Yeah, and his WSK knife, if I'm not mistaken, was originally 3/16 thick, and he was using 01 steel, which it's a great low alloy, very tough steel. I mean, he fetches a good price for his knives because they're good knives. 3/16 is a good thickness. Quarter inches, a lot of Tops stuff, and I'm not attacking Tops, but most of their stuff, in my opinion, falls closer to the sharpened crowbar world. It's indestructible. I mean, my God, you could pry a car apart with most of their blades. You know, this is not a me versus them, but I really like things in the 1/8 to 5/32 thickness. 3/16 maybe. If you know, I do make one big chopper, but you know, you need some heft. And honestly, I would probably redesign it. Truth be told. Yeah.
Well, the thing that we all noticed about it, because I mean, you know, everybody plays show and tell with blades. I mean, the thing that we all noticed about it when we were actually playing with it, using it, cutting through a bunch of stuff, and you know, trying to figure out what sort of freaking real life purpose this thing was gonna serve, the grinds were super, super duper thick. And, you know, it just seemed like to me for a blade like that, you would want to have a more shallow grind that goes further up the blade. That's why I favor other designs like, you know, for example, what Justin Gingrich is doing with Ranger knives that Ontario picked up and carried on. The Rat 7. That design and you know, basically the entire Rat series, but having a full flat grind coming out and you know, down having a nice edge, this there really good for cutting, good cutting ability, you know, doesn't necessarily perfect everything else. And again, you know, quarter inch thick is a little ridiculous, but I mean, Topps knives, as far as I know, and I could be wrong about this, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was started by a former SF guy, I think. And he, the very first knife that they designed, the 1/7 or something like that, was designed to cut through aircraft.
There you go.
So, I mean, you would want a knife that thick for that. But I wouldn't want to carry it around. That's a little, it's a little much, man. It's a little much.
No, but, you know,
or go ahead.
Well, on that subject, what knife making taught me over the years? I'm regrettably, you know, formally out of the business. I do it now purely as a hobby and a kind of on demand deal. But that aside, what it taught me over the past 16 years was there's a compromise in everything. There's a compromise in material. There's a compromise in geometry. There's a compromise in the hardness. You know, everything's a trade-off. Everything. And so you know, to get that idea out of your head and bring it into the world, you know, what am I doing? Am I making a knife to cut out of aircraft? Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if I'm making a quote bushcraft knife, so, you know, light prying, batoning, general chore work, you know, that 3 3/4, really more closer to 4 1/4 inch, about 5/32 thick, full flat high and grind. That really meets a lot of those needs. That's not what I would give maybe an aviator. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly, man. Exactly. And you know, your thoughts on that echo an interview that I was reading with Mike Perrin from SE Knives, and Mike Perrin and Jeff Randall, I don't think they need any introduction to guys like you and I that are into knives and are into wilderness survival and all that. But that's basically what he was saying with the SE5, is that he didn't understand why the SE5 was popular with bushcrafters, because it was not designed for that at all. That's actually not a good knife. It was specifically designed to cut your way out of a downed aircraft.
I have some opinions on that.
Yeah.
My thoughts on that knife is that, for one, out of all the knives that they make, it has the smallest choil. Okay. And for folks listening who don't know what a choil is, choils are really popular right now. That is the large half circle or circular cutout that people will often refer to as kind of a finger nook or a somewhere you can kind of choke up and get a good grip. The number 5 has a very small one compared to the number 4 and the number 6. Yeah. My opinion on it is why would I want to compromise where my hand goes? Just give me more of the grind closer to the actual handle. And so that's kind of where the number, or the Rat 5, falls short. Essie's model, that
yeah.
is.
Yeah, yeah.
That, and it's super thick, and it has what's called a saber grind. And a saber grind, the traditional definition of it, is that it goes approximately halfway up the blade. So from the cutting edge to the middle of the width is where that primary grind begins and terminates. And so it's full thickness for half of the width of the blade. It is very stout. I'm a big boy, and I'll tell you what, you could drive that into a tree and I could probably bounce right off of it. It's undoubtedly strong, but yeah, for bushcrafting, it's totally, totally overbuilt.
Right.
But that length.
Man, and I agree with that. Yeah. But the length is good. Having a 5-inch blade or 5-inch or so blade is just about perfect for everything that you want to do. You know, at least in my experience.
One knife that I'm really excited about coming out, actually. My two favorite knife companies is Cold Steel and Condor. And regrettably, hardly none of either of their companies' stuff is made in America. Some of Cold Steel's is, and none of Condor's is, to my knowledge. But
yeah,
what
they're
really
all made in El Salvador. But that's Condor is a good company, man. I got a bunch of knives from them.
They really are. Their quality is good, and what I really love about them is both companies, Cold Steel and Condor, their products are super diversified. I mean, you can go I'm not a sword guy, but you can go and get European swords and maces and lances. You can get Japanese swords, but then you can also get my all-time favorite tool, the Special Forces shovel or the Spetsnaz shovel.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
All-time
favorite knife is SRK. And now, where I was going with all this is that they just came out with the SRK Compact. So it's, I think,
that
4 millimeter
cool.
thick. Oh, it's great. Instead of a 6-inch blade, it's got a 5-inch blade. Instead of a 5 millimeter thick blade, it's a 4 millimeter thick blade.
And, you know, you told me a story when we were talking not that long ago. I think it was a couple weeks ago. We were talking over the phone. And you actually told me that all these years I've skinned a lot of deer with the SRK. You know, I bought one, I think, on my first trip to Iraq, brought it home, gave it to my brother. And, man, we have cleaned a lot of deer with that blade. But I have always thought, and, you know, there's a lot of people online that have thought this too, I always thought that the Cold Steel was a licensed copy of the Fallen Even.
Mm-hmm.
And you told me that wasn't so.
No, as I understand it, Fallen Even, I hope I'm pronouncing the name right, they were actually a distributor of Cold Steel products. And I believe that ceased. I don't know the nature of that relationship and why it ceased, but they got into production themselves afterwards. And I think people think that either A, because they read it and it persists, or B, because Fallen Even is recognized as a premium company.
Oh,
Blades are, you know, their fit and finish is pretty darn good. The material choice is pretty darn good. And nowadays, they're super expensive knives. And they're using some really exotic alloys. And they have the laminated blades, which Cold Steel markets as Sanmai, which in Japanese is three layers. I don't know the term for it, but there's also five layers and seven layers. It's common in Japan. That was just a little fun fact I found out when I was doing some research.
That's cool, man. That's cool.
But yeah, Fallen Even makes some great knives. I've got some time behind the S1 and the F1, and they're both great. Little thin. I've got weird hands. I got a big palm and little sausage fingers. And it's weird. The hand fit on a lot of knives is very odd, but I mention that because of ergonomics. The ergonomics on a knife handle matters. And going back to those fantasy blades, so many of them have horrible handles.
Yeah.
So some of them are great blades, even decent materials, all that good stuff. But the handle, to sell a knife, it's got to look sharp, no pun intended. And it just, the ergonomics suck. When you actually go to use it in the field.
And there's nothing worse than picking up a blade because you're window shopping and you're like, man, that thing looks cool. I'm going to take it out. I'm going to do some cool stuff with it. And you get down to really doing some technical tasks, cutting notches or, striking a ferro rod or doing whatever, cleaning game. And you find out that blade just absolutely sucks.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've all done it. We've all, you know, splurged on a blade we thought was really cool. And then, you know, you end up with something that's not so great. You know, but what I've found is that I favor the most simple designs, you know, just keep it really simple. The old school rat line, and what SE is doing now, they, you know, modified their stuff a little bit, but with Condor as well, because you're getting simplistic designs that the end user can tailor to their needs. You know, like I've got a Rat 7 and a Rat 5 that I've modified the handles on. You know, I've sanded them down. They feel really good in the hand. I don't have any issues with it. I've done that with a couple of Condors too. And, you can kind of, they give you enough meat there to where you can tailor it to your hand. So when you're doing all those tasks that, you know, you don't feel obstructed by it, so to speak.
You made a lot of good points there. What's really interesting is, tools are often a product of their culture, and with knives, I mean, there's a reason that we call European kitchen knives European kitchen knives. France, England, German, there's some small differences, but they're all relatively the same. And one of the big philosophical differences between European knife making and Japanese knife making, for example, is we use mono steels, so it's one type of steel the whole way through. And it's for a whole bunch of reasons, one of which is that steel is plentiful. We can smelt steel, the technology is there. But in Japan, from a traditional perspective, the natural resources were limited, and so they would laminate the steel because the high carbon steel was an absolute premium. And iron was more readily available, so you'd laminate it together. Where I'm going with this, though, is that there are legitimate differences that are that have just come to fruition on a cultural level, and what has stuck around these days, these old traditional styles, they've stayed because they work. If they didn't work, yeah, people wouldn't use them. They wouldn't embrace something that was painful or inefficient. And so, almost any knife you see marketed as a bushcraft knife has almost always got a straight back to it. The point tends to be in line with the middle of the handle. And, you know, they tend to be full tang. You know, these few characteristics lend themselves to being, you know, a robust, sturdy, reliable knife. Carbon steels are favored because they're easier to sharpen in the field. And when you're actually doing real tasks, and you should know, you know, you've done real tasks in the field. I've went out and played in the woods for a while, but that's, you know, different. And boy, there's nothing like knocking your knife into a rock, putting a ding in it. You're never sharpening that ding out when you're out there.
No.
It's you just there, work man. Around it.
Yeah, it's there. It is there.
So you really appreciate those steels that are gonna instead of chipping out and causing damage, they tend to be a little bit more forgiving because they're lower alloyed and so on and so forth. It's too much minutia, but the point being is, yeah, these traditional materials and these traditional styles, they're a little reinvented, sure. You know, micarta and some other small improvements.
G10 and all that.
Oh, yeah. And on that note, I very much, very much prefer micarta over G10. G10 seems to be a little bit softer. If you use G10 for a long time, it kind of develops a wear pattern in it. It's a small thing. It's still a great material. It's very resilient. But I very much appreciate micarta over G10.
Well, me personally, I like micarta because, you know, the question has come up in the past. I've had people either training with me or just, you know, the back when I actually had free time. And I was out in the woods doing woods running, and I'd have people ask about the whole walnut handles and hickory handles versus micarta and sanitation when you're doing food prep. And so for me, I always favor micarta because it's easier to keep clean. You can scrub it and it'll be fine. It'll be perfectly fine. Whereas if you take like a walnut handle, you have to keep a coating of beeswax on that to keep it sealed. And I mean, it is kind of splitting hairs, but for me, it was just one of those things that I've always favored micarta because I can keep micarta clean. I can scrub it. I can use a little bit of dish detergent on it and just scrub it out, and that blade is good to go. And I know that, you know, I'm not going to run any risk of contaminating my food, contaminating my meat with it, or, you know, any of the things, the camp chores that you're doing, food processing or anything like that, versus some of the other materials. In G10, I don't know. I don't know what I don't know about G10. And so I just stick with what I know works.
So a couple thoughts on that. I don't know the official USDA guidelines, but I can tell you that in any kitchen I've ever been in, it's all stainless steel blades and they all have polypropylene handles. And polypropylene is kind of a slick plastic. They don't offer the best grip, so they always have texture molded into them.
Right.
So that's for big manufacturers, and that's for that's all for sanitation reasons.
Right.
When you start getting into pro level chefs, not just a cook in a restaurant, but a chef with maybe their name on the building. These guys are, you know, rolling with $15,000 of custom cutlery. At that point, you still often see them using stainless steel. I don't know what it is about carbon being unsanitary. I don't know that that's the case. I do know that when you start working with acidic foods, that the acids will not only stain the carbon, they'll actually they'll dull it. You know, because we're not talking about you at home cutting a tomato. We're talking about a chef cutting tomatoes for 4 hours to the point where his skin might be a little blistered. Due to the acidic, you know, the citric acid. So, as far as woods go, I've done some stabilization of woods. And for folks who don't know, basically what that means is that, you know, there's air pockets in wood. It with like oak tends to be an open grain wood. It absorbs moisture readily. Well, that's not so great if, you're in wet conditions with a field knife. It's really not so great if you're dressing out a deer and you got blood in the handle and you don't care for that. So when you stabilize, there's different methods, but basically you're going to put some sort of polymer or acrylic in a pot. You're going to put the wood in there and you're going to do one of two things, sometimes both. You're going to draw a vacuum so it sucks all the air out of the wood. And then when you break that vacuum, it's submerged in the polymer, so it sucks, instead of air going back in those voids, it sucks the polymer in there, and then you bake it. The other option is that you do that, and then you pressurize it. And when you do that, yeah, you get a little better coverage, and I think that's what most professional outfits do. And then the materials that are used, it's esters and polymers, it's chemistry I'm not familiar with. Just follow directions on the bottle and, you know, you'll be good. So what I can tell you, though, is that that wood will polish up really nice now. If you've ever spilt super glue on anything and you take steel wool to it, it'll shine. It'll shine like it's been oiled. And that's kind of what happens when you stabilize wood. As a knife maker, if you use like really nice burl wood or wood that's got a unpredictable grain to it. If you've ever seen your grandpa's, you know, pocket knife, a lot of the times it will crack and swell. And when you stabilize it, it really helps prevent all that. It doesn't absorb moisture. It doesn't shrink due to, you know, dry air. It's just that it's stabilized. And, you can also add dyes and all that other stuff to it. You can do it with bone and any other porous material. But moral of the story is it does really up the sanitary capability of materials by stabilizing them.
Right on, man. Right on. And, you know, my only experience with stabilized wood is in gun stocks, like laminate stocks and diamond wood, those materials, that's really my experience with it. Never in knife handles though. And I think you take like some Coca-Bolo and you could make a really, really just beautiful looking knife handle.
You know, Coca-Bolo is a naturally oily wood. It's also, by the way, if you're a woodworker, it's an extreme irritant. It'll scratch your eyes and make you cough. You got to be cautious working with some of that material. You mentioned diamond wood. So as far as I know, diamond wood, the actual manufacturing plant burnt down in August of 2014. I was using their materials for my handles almost exclusively, for quite some time because it's a it's first off, it's sharp looking. It's great. If you like laminated gun stocks, you know, man, it's awesome. So that stuff was 1/10 of an inch strips of birch veneer that was stained, resin impregnated, and then laminated together. I've been fortunate enough to do some heat treating for a ice carver who also makes ice carving bits, and he had a diamond wood handle submerged in the presence of water for 18 months straight, and it swelled about 5%, but never rotted. So all in all, you know, does it swell? Does it take on a little water? Yes, but any permanent negative effects? Apparently not. So,
yeah, so it's, if you were living somewhere like the Pacific Northwest or the Smoky Mountains where you're getting a significant amount of rainfall and you're tearing off into the bush and you're going to be out there for an extended amount of time, you're saying that would be probably your go-to material?
I'd still choose micarta. You know, the only thing that really attacks micarta is solvents. And I also like micarta either bead blasted or left with a really rough finish, because it gets very grippy when wet. But as far as diamond wood goes, it's not a bad choice. I like it. I mean, it's real wood. It's been treated. It looks fantastic. You can get it in a myriad of colors, including rosewood and cocobolo. And, you know, it's a really stable quality product. And one more thing I will say about it is I've dropped mine. I've thrown it into things, all kinds of stuff. It's durable. And when you drop it square on the edge, some materials like corian and some polymers, they like to break. So the butt of your knife, the heel will sometimes bust off if it's made of plastic or synthetics. This stuff doesn't. It's pretty durable.
Right on, man. Right on. So on that topic about durability, survivability, describe for us your one knife, man, like your ideal blade.
Okay. Well, based on everything that I know and my experience, which is limited compared to some and vast compared to others, I would go with a knife probably around 9 to 9.5 inches overall length, 4.25-inch blade, 1.25 inches wide on the blade, probably a full height flat grind. And just to explain what that is for maybe non-knife guys, that means that the wedge shape, okay, where the blade starts getting thinner all the way down to the edge, starts at the spine and then goes all the way down to the cutting edge. Either that or what's called a 3/4 height grind. So you'd have the full thickness for 1/4 of the width. As far as the thickness of the blade, I really, really like 5/32. It's thin enough to cut through a lot of stuff, and it's thick enough to tolerate batoning and a fair amount of prying. The handle, I'd go with the OG solution, just the green micarta. It's classic. I like it. Specifically, I like canvas micarta, which is the most coarse.
You and I both, man.
There's linen and paper, and those both look fantastic. They're just a little too smooth for me. For a handle fasteners, I would use Corby bolts, they look like giant bolts, but they're actually pins that screw in that have a head that's countersunk into the handle. I've been using West Systems G-Flex epoxy. So not only do I use a physical fastener, the Corby bolts, but I also use a chemical fastener in the form of that epoxy. That epoxy is just some tenacious, tough stuff. going back to the blade, drop point, not a spear point. Spear point falls directly in the middle. I like something about 1/3 down to 1/4 down. And then I started doing something on one of my last blades that I made, and it was a blade that I made for myself. I started grinding the pommel at about a 30-degree angle on both sides. And so it produces a pommel that is soft enough for me to tap my open palm. You ever had to drive your point into something, but really precisely?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So you know, you hold your knife in the reverse grip, which is, say, it upside down, like you're going to stab something. And then you take your hand, your other hand, with an open palm, and you just bop it really gently. Well, if you've got a skull crusher pommel, or if you've got like the Becker pommels that are squared off, those aren't too comfortable to hit your hand on.
No.
So my solution to that is to take a pommel and just kind of non-aggressively wedge it. You can still bop somebody with it. You can still break glass with it. You can still baton the butt of a knife with it. And it's putting the pressure primarily on the tang of the knife and not the handle scales. And that right there is the justification for it.
And so the ideal purpose for this, for anybody that is wondering about just why in the hell you would do this, cracking coconuts.
Yeah, sure.
Coconuts. I'm telling you, if your hands are already slippery and wet, you know, seeing Hawaiians, Samoans out in Hawaii and hanging out with some of them, as I had the honor of doing, these guys will use a thick bladed machete for just about everything. Filipinos do this too. But if you don't have that on you, and, you know, maybe you're like me and you're just thinking like, man, I really don't want to lop part of my hand off accidentally here, you know, in a survival situation where you might cut yourself, and that could be that. Ain't nobody coming to rescue you. You know, you can use that to crack open a coconut. You could use that to crack open other types of fruit. It's a useful thing. It's a useful implementation.
Yeah, and getting back to reality, you're right. It is useful. Some of these pommels that are on some of the knives are pointed, and I mean, God help you if your knife rides up off of your hip and you walk into something, and that goes into you.
Yeah.
Some of them are really aggressive, and you know, when you look at it, you think in your mind when you see that catalog or you see the video, oh man, that's so bad. It's really bad when you mess up with it. It's just, there's a time and a place, but guys who are doing any real work that I know, there's a reason this stuff was invented in the last, you know, 25 years, and it's to sell knives. Right. It's very limited. Down where I trained, I had two guys approach me, and they're like, boy, I really like this 4-inch bladed knife. And I said, well, why is that? And they're like, well, because when you stab a man from behind, you go in front of him and drive that knife into his chest. And in Vietnam, we were going through these guys and stabbing our flak jackets. And, you know, I looked at him and said, you know, I don't really have conversations like that with my friends. It's more like, boy, today's work was hard or something like that, you know. But that's a consideration as a knife maker I'd never had before. You know, 4 to 6 inches for guys who are doing real deeds. Yeah. Okay. That's noted. You don't forget that lesson.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, you're talking about the average, you know, spine to chest cavity of a person. You know, you're not talking about a huge spread of space there. You know, you're gonna have 6 inches or so before it's coming out of the front. You know, but I mean, and talking about the whole knife fighting thing, There's a lot of realities to that. I mean, as you know, with knife fighting, you are going to get cut regardless. If you've got a knife and they've got a knife, there ain't no Hollywood, you know, duel kind of crap. Like, nah, you're getting stabbed. That's gonna suck. And you know, but the other part about that is that you want to have a knife that's fast and maneuverable, not something that, you know, the Jack Hawk 9000 that takes a lot of force and is slow, because it ain't gonna work, man. Like I'm looking over here at the bookshelf and I've got Kill or Get Killed up there.
Is that Rex the Fairborn Sykes?
Yeah,
or Rex,
yeah.
Applegate, I think maybe.
Applegate. Well, Fairbairn was a his buddy. I mean, that was his British counterpart, and for the SOE, Special Operations Executive, and then Colonel Applegate was OSS, and you know that book was really instrumental in reflecting the thought of the time. These guys didn't have years to come up with a doctrine. They just had to go off of what they had right then. And right beside that book, I've got another one called Guerrilla Warfare. Not the one by Che Guevara, but another guy before him. This guy named Bert Levy. And, you know, his version of guerrilla warfare was very similar to Rex Applegate, because they talk a lot about knife fighting. And Bert Levy is a guy that for everybody that's listening, you just need to look this dude up. He's a very, very interesting character. Bob Brown, Colonel Brown from Soldier of Fortune, wrote the introduction to this book. He's a fairly interesting fellow. So definitely worth a look. But the similarities between these two guys' preferences and fighting knives were readily apparent. And one of the things that I took from Kill or Get Killed, and I've got one of the original editions of it, is that Colonel Applegate said in it, your killing knife is not your tool knife. It is not a knife that you'll pull out and use all the time. It's not a utility knife. That's not what it's for. That's not what this is.
That's a very interesting distinction.
It. Yep.
Not to cut you off there.
Go ahead.
I recently read that I think the CIA was using the Cold Steel Koban, the current one, not the older one, which I think is just a 4.5-inch tonneau knife. It's one of their cheaper blades too. I want to say it's around $30. And because it packs really flat. And I mean, that's not my line of work, but I wasn't surprised by that. And it's not quite as long as those stilettos, but boy, does that have a piercing tip on it and a wide blade that can you know, make deep lashes.
You know, that brings up another guy that when I was coming up, I read several of his books, but this guy by the name of Frank Camper, who was a LERP in Vietnam and went on to run his own training school in the 80s, and he's another really colorful guy. But in one of his books that I have, he talks about knives, you know, the do's and don'ts of knives. And he was kind of taking shots at Randall and all that, saying, you know, guys would carry high end custom blades out into the field, and then they would get, you know, they would end up having to use it, and they didn't want to, you know, if they had to ditch it, they felt bad about having to ditch their gear because they spent all this money on a knife. You know, always carry an inexpensive knife for doing real business. And, you know, that's kind of a mantra that a lot of guys, like, I have my high end knives that I have, but I don't use all the time. And then I have my user beater blades.
Sure. You know?
If that makes sense.
No, it absolutely makes sense. You know, as a knife maker, my favorite blades to make were presents. Whether that's anniversary presents, whether that was a kind of a dad and lad's first deer hunt present, yeah, or Christmas presents, you name it. Because I knew that those knives were going to be treasured, and they were less about me and more about the memory of whoever bought it from me, giving it to the recipient. And it's nice to know that what you made is going to be, you know, hopefully treasured by somebody and taken care of and around way longer than I am. And so, yeah, there's definitely a place for real work knives. I carry a Bird Caracara 2, and I'll be honest with you, my favorite feature about that is that the thumb ramp will open a can of paint. And it's thick enough. It's thick enough that it won't break. You know, and they work $20. I think they're up to about $30 now. But no, I got zero problems with a high value, low cost knives. I love Open L's, and they're about as cheap of a good blade as you can get.
Open L's good.
$8 to $15. They're super thin ground. They're convex. They come in 1070 high carbon or 12C27 stainless. They do a good job, and they're in every size anybody would ever want. You know, there's
Open L's good, man. And I've got an old Duke somewhere around here.
Oh, nice.
A real one? And yeah, it's a real one. It's a real one. If for the listeners that may not know, the history of the Duke is a French knife, and it is it was a wartime production knife that was made in France, still made in France, and it's all out of stamped steel. So it is an incredibly thin. This thing disappears into your pocket. And it's a high carbon steel blade, so you can use this thing to strike a ferro rod, and it is so small and light that I used to have two of them. I gave one of them to a buddy, they have a very special significance to anybody who's involved in the Algerian War, whether it was the FLN or whether it was the French Paras. That were there, they all used this blade, and it's a really cool piece of history, but it's a very useful knife on top of that. And I don't really carry it much these days. It's sitting on top of the gun safe back here, and the reason that I don't carry it is because it disappears into your pocket,
sure.
So I mean, the way that I was carrying it for a while in, I'm not going to call it a completely non-permissive environment, but it was definitely, we'll say semi non-permissive, that I was carrying this Duke on the inside of a belt, and I was able to draw it. So I had it taped in there, and I was able to draw it using a piece of 550 cord that I had tied on it.
Now,
because one of the cool things about it is it doesn't have a belt clip or pocket clip or anything like that. It's very, very flat.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but Cold Steel makes a version called the Kudu. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So it's got the pull ring. I just wanted to make sure, because there's a ton of knives out there, but, that's an oldie. that's an old
yeah,
knife.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Yeah, it's old school, brother. It's old school. But, and for me, the knife, just like the firearm, just like anything else, is a tool, and you and I have had that conversation. It's definitely a tool. But shifting gears just slightly, you and I have talked about in the past about the survivalist mindset. And I think that is one that is really, really important, whether we're talking about the Chinese Wuhan flu virus or COVID-19, whatever you want to call it, or if it's, I'm in a plane crash in the middle of the jungle somewhere, or whether I'm just out in the woods for a weekend. Or all the way down to life living. But we've talked about different people that we've known with that survival mindset of I'm going to make it through this no matter what.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so dive into that a little bit, dive into that mentality and that mindset, and maybe describe some of the people that, you know, no matter what life throws at them, they're just going to make it through it.
Well, you know, I can only speak from my experience and my perspective. My journey kind of into the survival world started with Katrina. I think I was 20, maybe 21, and it really scared the hell out of me. And I went it with, you know, I was a young man and went into it with this militaristic mindset. And that mindset's not sustainable. First off, it's not positive. Second off, it's not, it's just not sustainable. I was sitting around waiting for something to happen for about 6 months. And that's because people were so far displaced up Highway 55 that it hit my home state and the town I was in Missouri, every hotel off of Highway 55. And so back to your question though, my take on it is this. I try to make buffer zones. I try to create stop gaps with the time and the money that I have. Usually that's in the form of equipment, because equipment solves problems. But the real value lies in knowledge and then experience. And so, you know, I'm not trying to throw a commercial out there for anybody, but, you know, I went to your class because I went and got my radio operator's license, my technician's license. Yeah. What do I know about radios? I'll tell you, nothing. And I certainly don't know how to use them when there's bad stuff going down and my pulse is up.
Right.
And the focus is on gathering information and communicating and keeping yourself, you know, out of trouble. And so, you know, I went and took that class. Now, maybe you can't travel. Maybe you don't have the budget for that. Read a book. Everybody's got a library.
Yeah.
And if your library doesn't have that book, they can order you one. You know, so I would say for folks who don't have a lot of money, they typically have a little more time. And for folks who don't have a lot of time, they tend to make a little bit more money.
Right.
So it's you're either self-educating or you're gaining training to make up for that that lack of knowledge. And then something I learned through some of the training that I've taken. I've got 400 hours of formal firearms training, to include, you know, pistol, precision rifle, carbine, but then also other classes like force on force and mass shooter scenarios and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I share that with you because I died a lot in those force on force classes. And, you know,
you mean you're not invincible?
That is correct. And I'm pretty open and honest about that. I've shared that perspective elsewhere on the internets, and, you know, the difference between me and my buddies who I tried to get to go with me and didn't go is, you know, we're both going to be crap in our pants. It's just I've got a game plan and some training to fall back on. And right. So part of it's stress inoculation. Part of it is facing some of these troubles before you actually experience real stuff. And the other part of it is getting introduced to the information for the first time and, you know, going somewhere with that. So to summarize, because boy, do I blather. I would say, you know, be open and honest with yourself. Try to eradicate your pride. You know, set your mind to receive. Don't be defensive about the deficiencies that you have, because we've all got them. I'm still super weak on commo. That's all there is to it. My gun handling skills are squared away. That's great, though. That doesn't help me talk to somebody, you know, that I need to talk to. So be open and honest about where your limitations are, and you know, try to fill that gap. And there's a bunch of ways to go do that. Training and self-education is the big one, and hopefully you start stacking that deck in your favor. You know, small, reasonable, incremental steps is healthy. Keep a positive outlook, and you know, going through all of that, yeah, it's a real self-confidence booster. So if your knees are knocking because of the virus right now, yeah, I understand that. And there's a lot of pressure on a lot of people. It's affected a lot of people's lives. But simultaneously, it's not the end of the world, not yet. And you got time, so leverage that time in your favor. If you're quarantined, go get a book, start reading, and take it seriously. And I think that would get somebody who's just starting out or very early on that path set in a good, reasonable direction with a healthy mindset, because that healthy mindset is really important.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I couldn't agree more with those statements, you know, and regarding COVID, you know, Wu flu, whatever you want to call it, the Chinese pneumonia virus. Man, there's an avalanche of survival lessons that people need to be taking from this right now. You know, I've had many really good conversations in the past few days. My email's been blowing up, phones are ringing off the hook, and there's a lot of people who really, they're either just now waking up to the reality of things, or it's really sinking in just how fragile a lot of stuff is, you know. And for me, at least, that's what being prepared, being a, I've always, you know, adopted the survivalist mindset versus just being a prepper. I've never called myself a prepper, so to speak. Because most of the people I know, and there's some really great folks that are into this, but when somebody says they're a prepper, normally that is predicated on them just going out and buying a bunch of stuff, you know.
Sure.
You nailed the core point about it. It's not about having a bunch of stuff. It's about having the underlying skill to use it. You know,
yeah,
I mean, whatever happened to being a Renaissance man, you know, knowing how to do this is like both my granddads could literally do anything. The mountain of knowledge they had was just incredible. And we forgot that in two generations. That's almost disappeared. And it's a shame in a lot of ways, but I think that we're going to return to that because a lot of people are waking up to the reality that we have a very fragile system, whether it's economics, whether it's supply chain, whether it's whatever it is, we have this severe fragility to it. And people have to know how, like, I'm not panicking over any of this stuff. You know, that's not what I'm doing. I'm sitting here listening to other people lose their minds, but me, you know, this is business as usual. I'm good to go.
There's so much I'd love to talk about. I tend to visualize things. And one of the mental models that I create is the depths of the ocean, and technology is just an oil slick floating on top. It's this super thin, very fragile layer that modern people, due to normalcy bias, rely on. And to be fair, it is fairly reliable. But, you know, we adapt to a lot of stuff. What we can't adapt well to is getting used to our rhythms being broken. And we have very fast-paced lives these days. That's our rhythm. And boy, that's being interrupted. And it causes tension in our lives on a personal level. But then there's the practical level. I mean, my work hasn't been affected. However, many people have, you know, and if you've got little ones in school and they're now homebound, I don't know what you do as a parent. And so I feel for those folks. Hopefully they have a plan and a solution in place. But once this blows over, you know, our infrastructure has been tested, our economy has been flexed on. There's some really good, strong lessons to walk away from here. And for people who thought preppers and survivalists and everybody else are just crazy, you make a good point. I mean, we're two generations, at least I am. I'm 36. I'm two generations removed from a great-grandfather who was plowing a field with a horse. And that's because he was poor. They had tractors, but he was doing it with a horse. They were still running root cellars. And this was a way of life. And so moral of the story here is a lot of lessons have been forgotten. I'm not saying you got to go caveman with everything. But, hey, have some hand tools around and have a decent idea how to use them. There is nothing to replace self-reliance when it's actually required. There is no substitute for it. And once again, as a guy who's prone to a little bit of anxiety from here and here and there, it's important for me personally to make sure I've got my stuff squared away.
That's right.
Because A, I don't want to go down that road, and B, I sure don't want to be a victim or rely on folks. It's different to have a favor done for you. It's another thing to actually have to rely on somebody. And very fortunate, I've got really good neighbors and good relationships with neighbors. And there's volumes could be spoke about networking in and of itself, but. Have your game squared away. Hopefully you're able to give more than you take. And that makes you a real asset in that game. So it's going from knives to this, knife is the first step in making sure you as an individual are squared away.
Yeah. Don't show up to the party with the Jackhawk 9000.
That's right. For me, it's a cold steel Gurkha Kukri. That is my big blade. I love it.
Yeah.
I've made a couple replicas. That's a good choice, man. It's beefy though, boy.
Yeah, I have an actual Gurkha house. The Himalayan Imports or Himalayan Exports. Gurkha house Kukri. I have the Afghan model, the one that the Gurkhas are carrying in Afghanistan.
Does that have the finger grooves in it by chance?
No, this one's a full tang. It's a full tang. Full tang 5160, absolutely made by hand. You can tell because this thing is every bit as crooked as a Southern lawyer. Man, you want to talk about an indestructible blade. Do you know... on that note, there's a lot of dudes that have run Kukris that really love them. Alan Kay, folks will know him from Alone. He's the winner of the first season of Alone. And, his knife that he carried out there was a Condor Kukri.
Yeah.
And, just took care of business out there. Kukri has a lot of advantages to me. But if going big, if I'm going to carry a big blade, it's going to be Artak 2 or Hunglus. Artak 2 kind of it came first. And then when when Jeff Randall split with Ontario, then they came out with a slightly modified Hunglus. It's got a little bit better of a handle. But that Artak's that is a good blade. And,
I think the newer ones are made out of 5160. The older ones are 1095.
Yeah, it's 51. The Artak is a 5160 blade, and it has been for the past few years. I know mine is 5160.
That's good, because the 1095 was having a tendency to snap where the foam jimping is.
Yeah, yeah, but man, good blades, man, good blades. Well, brother, as always, it is an honor to talk to you. I am so glad to have had you on this podcast. You got any final thoughts for us?
You know, I would just tell everybody, you know, look for the next opportunity that's out there for you. Stay positive about everything, and you know, do some good. Prepping world tends to be a lot of doom and gloom. Survivalists can be some really stubborn, tough guys, and you know, it's important to contribute and give, not just take. And you know, I tend to do that. I take a lot of folks out shooting, just try to be generous with my time and my knowledge. Not that I know much, but yeah, I would just leave that with, not to sound like a dirty hippie or anything, but yeah, try to bring some good in the world.
Yeah, man. Agreed, brother. Agreed. Well, anyway, until next time, man, thanks for being on with us.
No, my pleasure. Thank you.
I'll talk to you soon, bro.
Sounds good.